Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Build America, Buy America. New legislation with bipartisan support. How COVID has affected work in the United States. And today on the show, it's working class perspectives and the latest from the United Steelworkers. Welcome to the Friday, April 23rd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. Two guests on the show today. This is our segment, as I indicated, we call Working Class Perspectives, started at least a dozen years ago with John Russo and his wife, Sherry Lincoln, both now working in Washington at Georgetown University. Joining us today is one of their contributors, Christopher Martin. He's been on the show a number of times. Christopher is a professor of digital journalism at the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Northern Iowa, which is located in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He is author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. He's also author of an award-winning book on how labor unions are covered in the news media. That one's titled Framed, Labor and the Corporate Media. Boy, there was a time in the media where unions got a lot of play. In fact, they used to have labor reporters at virtually all the newspapers in America, and that's all changed, and that is primarily why we do this show. Unions need a voice, and we try to provide that five times a week on this show we call America's Workforce. Today's going to be an interesting discussion. We're going to talk about working class and the middle class. Christopher points out, when the news media talk about regular people or citizens, they usually mean the middle class. When advertisers sell things, they are likely pitching to the middle class. When politicians talk about Americans, they often talk about the middle class. So, the middle class is a nice catch-all term for the politicians and media saying middle class plays into the myth of a classless society. It does not speak of inequality, since it envisions a large, inclusive middle where just about everybody finds themselves. So what about working class? The working class majority, what about that? Christopher writes, the working class is made up of people who, when they go to work or when they act as citizens, have comparatively little power or authority. And it's estimated at least 60% of the U.S. labor force is part of the working class. How many times have you said, oh, I'm just a working stiff and I have no voice? That's the difference. And we're going to delve into this. This is quite fascinating. Working class, middle class. Chris Martin, our first guest. Randy Pearson will be joining us on behalf of the United Steelworkers, one of the many proud sponsors of this show. Randy is the National Rapid Response Coordinator. And I'll tell you, steelworkers have done amazing work with this. She'll give us an outline, if you want to call it that, going back a number of years on how the rapid response coordination began with the steelworkers and its effectiveness. Background on Randy, she's a fourth generation union worker out of Toledo, Ohio. Became a steelworker at Local 912 when she was hired at the Sunoco Toledo, Ohio refinery. That was back in 2006. During her time there, Randy took on several positions within her local union, from safety rep to union steward to chairperson for the Women of Steel Committee, then rapid response coordinator. She coordinated the local committee until 2017 when she became USW District 1 rapid response coordinator. And then in January of 2020, she became the national rapid response coordinator. And what we're going to talk about today is the Enbridge Line 5 pipeline what it is. Why does it matter? And we're going to talk about refinery workers and the environment. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute, you know, fossil fuels, refinery, you're hurting the environment. Well, we'll discuss all of that. And we're talking about protecting jobs. And they have a website dedicated to all this, futureontheline.org. Futureontheline.org. And there's a lot of information posted there about the importance of pipeline projects. And I'm just going to run down a couple of the bullet points here. Every day, members at the Toledo Refinery Company, which is one of the most environmentally friendly oil refineries in the world, produce enough gasoline to fill 224,000 cars, enough diesel to drive a semi from New York to Los Angeles 2,700 times. Enough jet fuel to fly around the world 42 times in a Boeing 737 jet with 100 passengers. I mean, that's a lot of fuel that's coming out of one refinery. So Randy Pearson will talk about that and much more as our second guest right here on the show. Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Rob Portman of Ohio, Republican and a Democrat, Gary Peters of Michigan, he's a Democrat, and Mike Braun, Republican out of Indiana, yesterday announced they are reintroducing legislation to ensure Buy America preferences apply to all taxpayer-funded infrastructure and public works projects. Companion legislation was also introduced in the House, and Tim Ryan out of the Mahoning Valley area in Ohio was one of the sponsors there, along with one individual out of Alabama and another out of Indiana. A lot of bipartisan support, as I indicated. Now, here's the story. Congress needs to move to quickly pass this measure because it works toward advancing infrastructure investment legislation. Not all federal programs that provide grants to infrastructure projects currently abide by Buy America, which means that foreign-made iron, steel, and other manufactured products have been used in some taxpayer-funded infrastructure projects. Scott Paul, who we've featured on the show many, many times, Scott is the head of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, said the following: as Congress and the Biden administration work together to invest in America's infrastructure, ensuring that it's made in the USA must be a top priority. That's why the Build America, Buy America Act, introduced along with companion legislation in the House, is so important. If Buy America does not apply to all taxpayer-funded projects, we're going to send that money overseas and leave good jobs on the table. So they are strongly, strongly endorsing this. I've got some more details, too, on how the law that we have on the books is being applied. Existing Buy America laws are very limited. They apply to only a fraction of projects. Currently, Buy America policies are not applied to broadband, water systems, airports, the power grid, school construction, housing construction, and many green infrastructure spending projects. Even long-established Buy America laws are not adequately applied. For instance, the Federal Aid Buy America law administered by the Federal Highway Administration at the Department of Transportation is applied to only iron and steel products due to an outdated 1983 waiver. And the Highway Administration estimates that these purchases, iron and steel, are less than 5% of the project's cost. As a result, foreign suppliers of commonly used materials like cement, plastics, aluminum, glass, and lumber, they have unfettered access to our tax dollar. Is that amazing? we've got some fixing to do here in America, and hopefully the fact that this has bipartisan support and the very fact that we have an infrastructure bill that Biden has introduced, this has to be discussed and implemented. This has to be. Cement, plastics, we make all that stuff. Interesting polling by Gallup. They've investigated how COVID-19 has affected the quality of work in the United States. The report included a series of very disturbing, though unsurprising, findings. Among the most notable, the study revealed that layoffs and income losses have disproportionately affected blacks and Hispanics and those with low incomes and less education. That fewer than 20% of workers without a college degree had access to remote work, and that fewer than half of workers in what's called low-quality jobs believe that their employer is taking the necessary precautions to keep them safe. Most disturbingly, in the Gallup survey, it showed that nearly half of all laid-off workers, half of them, struggle to afford food or shelter. And ultimately, more than half of those working in low-quality jobs experienced worsening job quality. I could see that, especially a lot of these companies not providing the proper protective equipment. Though the daily rate of vaccinations in the United States has ticked up impressively in recent weeks, the pandemic and the poverty of desolation that it has inflicted, according to Gallup, are far from being over. Boy, that's an eye-opener. Wow. Washington State Legislature has sent a bill to Governor Jay Inslee that would make Washington the first state in the country to guarantee time and a half pay for farm workers who work more than 40 hours a week. But let's not rush to judgment here. Listen, many workers in the United States are statutorily guaranteed time and a half pay through the Fair Labor Standards Act. However, the FLSA excludes people like farm workers, leaving their working conditions to be regulated, if at all, by the states. Now, this bill comes on the heels of a state Supreme Court decision finding it unconstitutional, this is in Washington State, to deny dairy workers overtime pay. Here's the deal. As the bill is currently written, it would require time and a half pay after 55 hours starting next year, with the overtime trigger falling to 48 hours in 2023 and then 40 hours in 2024. So they're going to get OT, but not right away. This kind of reminds me of the way they want to raise the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage. It's not to $15 like tomorrow. It's over 4, 5, 6, sometimes 7 years. But farm workers, I'll tell you, that's a tough occupation. And it's amazing that they have been excluded from the federal standards for this amount of time. All right, we have to break. You're listening to America's Workforce. When we come back, we're going to link up with Christopher Martin, the difference between middle class and working class.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy,
and the service sector.
We are steel workers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Mesothelioma is a rare type of cancer caused by exposure to asbestos. If you were exposed to asbestos and have mesothelioma or lung cancer, the trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Now, back to America's workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
I'm pleased to announce that I am co-sponsoring the PRO Act. 50% of unions fell in their first year of organizing. This legislation will level the playing field. I look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to move this bill through a legislative process.
That was a clip of Senator Joe Manchin announcing this week his support for the PRO Act. That's the Protect the Right to Organize Act. And that makes it 47 Democratic senators now in favor of that legislation, which has passed in the House. And Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, indicated if they get up to 50, which means they just need three more Democrats, that he will try to make it happen despite the talk of a filibuster kind of crushing it. Hey, you can help out. All you got to do is call this number, 866-832-1560. Build back better with unions. Call your U.S. senators and pass the PRO Act, 866-832-1560. Welcome back to the show. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the fine folks at the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment, ulagency.org, celebrating 50 years. Let's go to line number one right now. Welcome back to the show, Christopher Martin. Christopher is a professor of digital journalism at the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, Iowa, right in the heart of America. He's also author of a couple books. We'll touch on those. But right now, we're going to talk about working class and the middle class. There is a difference. Professor Martin, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you in Flash.
Bringing ourselves to say working class. That's the name of your piece. And this is our segment we do each and every month called Working Class Perspectives. Or should we say middle class perspectives, like you point out in your article. Talk to me about this. This is quite fascinating because we hear all the time middle class, working class. Well, what's the difference here? What's the story?
Well, I mean, part of what I was writing about was just how difficult it is for the news media to say working class instead of middle class, and politicians, too. You know, and I actually use the example of Joe Biden, who has some difficulty in saying that, too, even though, you know, he's a guy who throughout his career has been called working class Joe. He's been a little hesitant to use that phrase himself. And so there is a difference. You know, I mean, the working class are people, and I like to use the definitions, people who don't have much power or authority over their job, which would include most of us, like at least 60% of people who are working. You know, it's traditional blue class, they're blue collar people, I should say. But also, you know, people who include things like teachers and unions and retail workers. In fact, 80% of workers are service workers, and you know, most of those people are people who are working class. So, but we tend not to say that, and it's, you know, it's just part of American history that that we tend to shy away from saying working class because it calls into account the fact that there are people at different socioeconomic classes in America, and a lot of people just like to, the media and politicians included, like to deny that.
Uh-huh. Well, you point out that middle class kind of plays into the myth of a classless society. It doesn't speak of inequality. Can you delve into that a little bit more for us? I think that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, you know, that's the American myth that there isn't any kind of inequality here, that everyone has the same equal opportunity. You know, and people are born into different kinds of conditions, and so, you know, and are treated differently. So there isn't, you know, it's nice to think that everyone has the same exact equal shot, but, you know, we've seen that increasingly, you know, since the 1980s, there's a lot less class mobility and opportunity. So there is that problem. We just don't like to talk about it. And, you know, there was a researcher back in the 1950s who, you know, like he said, that class is almost entirely absent from the media. And that it's the very antithesis of the American creed to say, you know, that there is class. That was back in 1958. So it's been around with us for a long, long time. But we live that experience. We know it's not a classless society.
Well, because it's absent from the media, is that the media's fault for not calling attention to that? And I guess this is a two-part question. You know, the media's corporate today. In all shapes and forms, even social media with Facebook. I mean, that's corporate too. I mean, there's ways, kind of, I guess, to still express your point of view on that. But is it possible to kind of rattle the media on this and say, hey, let's talk more about this issue?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, that's kind of a little bit what I try to do is say, hey, you guys should be talking and using the word working class, and don't let the politicians set the agenda. I mean, you shouldn't wait for them to say working class. I mean, you can point that out yourselves. So you don't have to be, you know, just passing along what other people say. It's, you can use your own, you know, separate analysis and use the word working class, because that's the reality of people. So, you know, sometimes the media forgets, you know, and there's different ways to think about class. But for example, only 35% of Americans 25 years and older have a college degree. That's not good or bad, but it just kind of calls to effect that not everyone has that experience. In fact, the vast majority of Americans don't. And I think the media sometimes forgets that. They just think everyone's upper middle class. And you look at TV shows and you think everyone's upper middle class. And that's just, you know, we can't forget what America's like.
Yeah, yeah. And then a lot of people think, well, I'm a loser because I don't fit into that class. I understand that. You mentioned Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And the president, in his autobiography, promises to keep on life in politics, which came out some years ago. I guess here's an individual. In fact, he's been called Working Class Joe. I've heard that many, many times. Now, in that autobiography, and you point this out in your article, Biden mentions working class five times and middle class twice as many times. When Biden does write working class, it's not a subject, the working class, but instead an adjective that adds color to the description, like working class neighborhoods, working class town, working class steel town. Can you extrapolate on that? I mean, here's the president of the United States, who's a good guy, who's a union-friendly guy, who spoke out, and you pointed this out, too. He spoke out on the Amazon organizing campaign. How does that fit into this equation?
Well, you know, again, it's a little bit of his reticence. And I think, you know, it's not just something, a problem that Biden has. I think a lot of politicians don't want to say that there's a working class. So, again, he uses it, you know, more as an adjective, like it, to add color to the description. You know, he talks about himself, you know, in the neighborhoods he grew up in. And he said, at one point we were moving to the outskirts of Wilmington, to the working class neighborhood called the Claymont area, just across the Pennsylvania state line. But he didn't really think that he was working class himself. He said, you know, he says more that he's kind of a middle class kid from a certain neighborhood. You know, and it just shows the complicated nature that America has in trying to say whether someone's working class or middle class. And again, we'd like to believe that everyone's middle class, that we're all the same, but we're not. You know, at one point Biden says, he goes, I guess technically he was lower middle class because of the house he grew up in. So it's really difficult, but I think we can start to confront some problems and inequalities in terms of pay, in terms of how people are treated. If we say, like, hey, some people are working class, and that's not a bad thing to say, but it also means that, you know, let's pay people. You know, everyone should have a living wage, I think. You know, everyone should be treated with respect, I think. And so let's do that. Not think of working class as a put down, but just like, hey, you're just doing something different, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But let's compensate you well, and let's give you respect as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I know there's a lot of issues at play right now. The fight for 15, bring up the wages, the PRO Act. I just mentioned the PRO Act. That would obviously, there's 60 million people in this country that would join a union if given that opportunity. And they try to do that down in Bessemer, Alabama, and look what happened. So, yeah, raise the wages and bring that working class up so it has some power to it like it used to back in the 50s and the 60s. Let me ask you this, Professor. I really think this is a very, very good piece of writing that you put on, and I think I'm hoping that it takes off. Is it? I mean, what kind of when this is posted on the blog, I'm just wondering, are people saying, you know what, you got a good point there. Maybe we need to reframe what we're talking about. What are you hearing so far?
Well, you know, I think the thing that makes me a little bit more optimistic is the fact that journalists themselves are starting to organize into unions. I think, you know, there's nothing like your own situation to help bring things into clarity. And so a lot of journalists in the past 10 years have started to realize, like, hey, we're working class, too. We're not being treated very well in our positions. We're being treated like disposable workers. So I think there's a lot more empathy going on as journalists, you know, at major and minor newspapers and news organizations across the country have started to organize into unions. So I think increasingly they're starting to get that, which is a good mm-hmm. thing going forward.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot in the digital field, which is actually what you teach at the Department of Communications and Media. You know what? Let's talk more about journal. Can we do that in the next segment, Professor? Would that be appropriate? Very good. Christopher Martin is his name. He's a professor of digital journalism in the Department of Communication and Media, and this is out of the University of Northern Iowa, Cedar Falls. Also author of a couple books. We'll delve into that as well. We'll talk about the journalism profession and where that's going. It's been beat up here over the years, no doubt about that. Randy Pearson will be joining us later in the show. Randy is with the Steelworkers, and she's also the Rapid Response Coordinator. They've got an issue in Toledo at a refinery, Toledo, Ohio. She's going to talk about that and more. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to the show. Don't forget, we're available on 5 different platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Pandora. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and eventually give us a rating. We'd appreciate a 5-star rating. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find them online at oft.aft.org. We had Melissa Cropper, president of the Ohio Federation, on the show on Tuesday of this week. It's archived on awfradio.com. One of the discussion points was teachers being armed in school. And I understand a lot of teachers would like to be armed, considering what's going on in America. However, the legislation she referenced, HB 99, does not have any minimum standards when it comes to training. Now, if you're going to get a concealed carry license, there is a requirement of 8 hours training, 6 hours of which can be done online. So 2 hours in a shooting range, that's it. And the Fraternal Order of Police saying, you know what, we got to do better than that. So they have joined with the OFT saying, no, don't move this legislation forward unless you're going to do more training. And that is totally understandable. All right, let's go back to our live line and rejoin Christopher Martin. Christopher is a professor of digital journalism in the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Northern Iowa. This is our segment we do in each and every month called Working Class Perspectives. And we're talking about the middle class and working class. I want to talk about journalism, if you don't mind. Right now, what's the status of teaching in Iowa? Are you in class, virtual? Where do we stand right now, Professor?
It's kind of a mixed bag. So there are some classes that are hybrid. So you teach, some people are in the classroom spaced out wearing masks. Some are online. Some are completely online. Actually, that's what I'm doing this semester. And so we're all going to be back in the classroom in the fall, though. So I'm looking forward to that. I actually miss seeing people in person and not on a Zoom screen.
Yeah, that's tough. And you teach primarily digital journalism? I mean, you don't see much in print anymore, and it's all digital. Everybody's got their phones, iPads, so you primarily focus on that? And how does that work? I mean, is it a different kind of journalism? Explain that part to me.
It's still journalism. We still, you know, focus on good writing and reporting, but we also want students to be familiar with multiple platforms. So, you know, a lot of people are going to see their work, as you said, on a phone instead of, you know, in a print paper. We still teach, you know, how to do layout for newspapers, but we want people to be able to shoot video, to be able to record audio, to be able to, you know how to do social media posts of their stories as well. So we just want to make sure they can work across all the platforms, since we're, I think, in kind of a big transition in journalism in terms of how people get it across the country.
Right. I want to talk about the coverage of labor in journalism, too. But before we get into that, I'm just wondering how prepared your students and do you have some input into this on what they face in the world? And I bring this up because the Columbia Journalism Review did a story a couple of days ago about the protests in Minnesota. And this had to do primarily with the killing of Dante Wright. That was the individual who was killed with a handgun instead of a taser, and that was a well-trained police officer. And apparently, while those protests were going on, Joshua Rashad McFadden, a black freelance photographer, told the paper that the police surrounded the car he was in on. This was on Tuesday. As he was trying to leave the protest, he said, "It was scary. I've never been in a situation like that with so many police officers hitting me, hitting my equipment." And then he said the police didn't believe that his press credentials were real. And then Carolyn Sung, now Carolyn is an Asian American CNN producer. She was seized by police despite identifying herself as a journalist. Then she was zip tied. State police officer yelled, "Do you speak English?" She was then taken to a nearby jail where she was subject to an invasive search and forced to wait in a cell for several hours before she was finally released. All right. You're a professor of journalism. How do you sell this to your students? Talk to me about that.
That's not like the best thing to try to get students to go into the journalism major. You know, it's tough. I do talk about, you know, we don't yet have a class like specifically on how to stay safe while being a journalist, although we'll have to start covering that, I think. But I do tell journalists that, or student journalists, that it's, you know, it's a difficult occupation, and it's becoming increasingly difficult in the United States. So I'll give you an example. There's a group called Reporters Without Borders, which puts out an annual ranking of press freedom each year. And they just, a couple weeks ago, they just came out with a new one for 2021. And at the very top of it were kind of some of the usual suspects: Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Denmark. But what's most disturbing is that the United States has actually fallen on this ranking over the years, and we're now number 44. So after South Korea and Taiwan, and just before Tonga and Papua New Guinea, and that's not a good place for America to be in terms of press freedom. And part of it is, you know, some of the things you just explained, that there's increasing violence against journalists. You know, what happened in Minneapolis is that when one photojournalist asked why they were doing this, an officer reportedly said, because that's our strategy right now. And that shouldn't be any strategy by, you know, any kind of police group against the press. I mean, it shouldn't be oppositional. And it's actually sad that it's actually come to that in some situations. So I think I'm going to tell students to wear a big vest that says press on it, but that'll help them a little bit in identification, but it doesn't help, you know, if they're actually being targeted, which is, you know, been the situation, at least for some journalists in Minneapolis just the past week. So that's not a good thing.
No, not at all. And I just want to point out that the governor there, Tim Walz, who is a pro-union guy, he said that he was shocked by the allegations, and in a tweet he wrote that he had directed our law enforcement partners to make changes that will help ensure journalists do not face barriers to do their jobs. So it's good that he spoke out on it. Hopefully they'll listen. That's all I can say at this point, but it's scary. It really is. And like I said, I think you have to prepare the journalists of the future for things like this, because I don't know, we've really downgraded this profession. And my hat's off to you, and as far as, you know, hanging in there and still teaching these kids, because we need them. What is it, the fourth estate? We need to keep people honest in this country, the politicians and our taxpayers, and that's why we have the press. It's so darn important. Let's talk a little bit. We got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk about your books here. No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, and also Framed, Labor and the Corporate Media. And, you know, we've done this show. We started the show back in 1993, primarily because of the fact you don't have labor beat reporters anymore. And it's important that journalists, and I guess because you pointed this out, that they're organizing, they're starting to realize that they perhaps need a union. I'm just wondering, you see a change happening here? We may not see it in print, but maybe in the digital world. What's at play here? What do you think?
Yeah, there is, you know, and I think that the digital media have kind of jumped on this a little bit faster, you know, adding back in a labor beat, because they realize that there's a, you know, an audience out there for that. That people aren't, you know, they're not seeing their story in the media. So there are a number of outlets like ProPublica in these times, the Center for Public Integrity, BuzzFeed, Vice, HuffPost, Bloomberg, Politico, that have been adding back in labor reporters. Actually, even Teen Vogue, you know, of all places, has a labor reporter that reports on things. So, you know, so teens can learn about, you know, what it's like to be part of a labor union. I think that's a great idea. And more of that would be good for people. I mean, I think people need to hear stories about what their lives are like, what it's like to try to organize. And we know that it's a really difficult thing to do, you know, especially from what just happened in Bessemer, Alabama.
That's a really good point right there. And I think, I don't know if you've been monitoring the media coverage out of the Alabama situation, because, well, first of all, it's reinvigorated labor. You heard me talk earlier about the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize. And there's 60 million people in this country that would want to join a union if they didn't have to go through the garbage like they did in Bessemer, Alabama. Professor, have you monitored any of the coverage on that organizing campaign? Because it seems to me it's just showing that we have weak labor laws. I don't know. Maybe that's coming from, I'm a union guy. Maybe that's the way I'm viewing it. Any take on that? What's your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It actually did get a lot of media coverage. I think, you know, in some ways it was kind of a classic, you know, David and Goliath story. So you have Jeff Bezos as literally the guy who kind of looks like Lex Luthor heading up Amazon. And then you have, you know, these workers who are making about $15 an hour, which is okay, but it's actually in some ways not as good as a number of the other type of warehouse jobs around Bessemer, Alabama. So so they lost, but, and I think in the coverage to come out of that, I think people started to realize more like, hey, You know, in Karchek, the majority of people wanted to organize, but when it came down to the actual union vote, they really lost in a bad way. And so that actually really points to the PRO Act and protections needed for workers as they organize. So I think it actually draws attention to that act as something that we really need. Because if most workers, you know, in America, and polls have shown this out, would like to join a union, yet when it comes around to trying to do election, you can't do that mm-hmm. very well, then I think it really points a point. It points to that we need legislation to help us, to make the elections more fair.
There you go. Do me a favor, Professor. Tell your students to call that toll-free number that I mentioned in the first segment, 866-832-1560. Call your senators. We got three Democrats right now that have not spoken out. We picked up two votes in the past week, Angus King out of Maine and Joe Manchin out of West Virginia. And hopefully we can move this legislation forward. It'll help them, too. You know that, especially now with all the organizing in digital journalism. Professor, a great conversation. Always a pleasure having you on. And you do have to check out his article about the working class and the middle class. That's at workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. Let me repeat that, workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. You take care. Stay safe in Iowa. And we'll be checking in with you down the road. How's that sound?
Great. I look forward to it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Randy Pearson is with the Steelworkers, also heads their rapid response team, and she's next.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at boydwatterson.com.
Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with cancer after taking Zantac? If you have taken Zantac and have cancer, you may be entitled to compensation. The trial lawyers at Kelly & Ferraro may be able to help you. Find us at kellyandferraro.com. Kelly & Ferraro, trial lawyers.
Millions manage their benefits online, so they can do what they want offline. Social Security, securing today and tomorrow. See what you can do online at socialsecurity.gov.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And welcome back to the show. Don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle is at AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation, of course, affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Also affiliated with the AFL-CIO and the United Steelworkers, USW.org, a proud sponsor of this show we call America's Workforce. And joining us on line number two is Randy Pearson. Randy is a fourth generation union worker from Toledo, Ohio. She became a steel worker at Local 912 when she was hired at the Sunoco Toledo, Ohio refinery. And that goes back to 2006. So we're talking 15 years. And in the last couple of years, she got involved in the rapid response team. And we're going to talk about that and also what's going on in Toledo with this pipeline, the Enbridge Line 5. Hey, Randy, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Did I get all your background correct? The fourth generation union worker, maybe you can give me some more details on that. Sounds like you come from a very, very strong and rich union family. Talk to me about that.
I do. So I grew up with my grandparents kind of as a central driving force in my life. And my grandfather worked at a refinery, an oil refinery growing up. And his dad before that, and his dad before that, and his dad before that. And his brothers worked there. And, you know, getting out of college, I had a lot of student debt. I actually went to school to be a nurse. But I was looking for a job. He told me that the refinery was hiring. I don't think anybody thought that I would be the one to carry on this legacy. But here I am, you know, many years later, and had a great career at the refinery there in Toledo.
I like that. Unions are in your DNA. I like that. I like that.
Absolutely.
Randy, talk to me about rapid response. I've talked about this with various guests on the show over the years, and I think it's super. It really is, because unions, I mean, they educate and they activate, and this is the activation part. Maybe you can explain how this works, rapid response.
Yeah, so rapid response is our education, engagement, and empowerment program for our members at the USW, where we get involved in issue-based campaigns on legislation. So we are nonpartisan. This has nothing to do with politics for us. It's all about getting our members involved and sort of active in issue-based fights on legislation that affects them at their job, at home, the things that really affect union members in their everyday life.
Gotcha. So I'm reading that you were the District 1 Rapid Response Coordinator. You started there, and then in January of last year, you became the National Rapid Response Coordinator. So you've got obviously more duties, and there's a lot of fires, so to speak, that you have to work on right now and get some action on. One of them is the Enbridge Line Number 5. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so Enbridge Line 5 is a pipeline that travels from Canada down through Wisconsin and Michigan and then back into Canada. But it's especially important to many of our members because it really is like an energy highway for the Midwest. It delivers crude and natural gas liquids that are then refined down into things like propane, gas, diesel, jet fuel, and a myriad of other chemicals that are used to make the goods we use in our everyday lives. Enbridge Line 5 has been there since about 1953. And the sort of the piece that's right now at issue is the piece that travels on the lake bed of the Straits of Mackinac. Over the last few years, there's been an increased sort of attention paid to this section of the line due to an anchor strike of the line that happened a few years ago. Since then, the line's been inspected. It's deemed safe. FEMSHA, which is the regulatory agency that looks at it, has given it the A-OK to continue running. But, you know, something like that really draws added attention to the possible risks that it may create for the lake. And since then, there's been a ton of attention on this one section of the line. And unfortunately, it's right now part of a legal battle where they're trying to shut it down. So the big thing for us and for labor and really anybody that lives in the Midwest is that if you shut down this pipeline without an alternative, things like the cost of gas, the supply of jet fuel, propane and heating oils for the state of Michigan and some of Northwest Ohio will then become scarce, and you'll see sort of prices go up on these things. So it's a really important issue, but at the heart of this issue for me is that the Toledo Refining Company, which used to be the Sunoco Refining Company that I was hired into, they get the majority of their crude from this line, which means that if they shut this line down, I have roughly 350 of my brothers, sisters, and siblings that are out of a job.
Ooh, are we close to that happening right now if nothing is done?
Well, right now, as I said, it's sort of in a legal battle, but there's a solution. There is a common sense solution that Enbridge actually is in the middle of trying to execute, which is to build a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac in through the bedrock and then move the pipeline there. So it would completely eliminate the risk to the waterways and the Great Lakes, which, you know, we think that's great. The big thing about that is that Enbridge has, they will be paying for it. So it comes at no cost to the taxpayer. It will create tons of jobs in that area of Michigan. And also it will continue to let our refineries, our energy independence, et cetera, in the Midwest continue to be a force there.
So this tunnel project, I mean, is that being planned for despite what's going on in the courts on this legal battle? I mean, what is that going to be the ultimate solution here or what?
So the tunnel project is being planned for. In fact, Enbridge has done all the necessary core sampling and engineering. They're now in the permitting process, and that is moving along. But the issue becomes if you shut down this section of Line 5 prior to the tunnel being built, it's not sustainable for the refinery that I came out of definitely would close. And we'd have a serious impact to transportation fuel costs in the Midwest for a while if Enbridge then decided to go through with building the tunnel.
Yeah.
Because as we all know, you know, business decisions, when they see that this refinery is closed and other things start to close down, it may not make good fiscal sense for them to continue this project.
And I want to tell our listeners right now, anytime one refinery shuts down, even for a short amount of time, that's going to have an impact on prices. I've seen this happen so many times. What happened in Texas about 6 weeks ago with the freeze, that shut down the refineries down in the Gulf Coast. You saw gas prices spike back then. Just to go over some of the numbers here, and I touched on this at the beginning of the show, the impact of the Toledo Refining Company. Enough gas to fill 224,000 cars, 15 gallons each, diesel to drive a semi from New York to L.A., 2,700 times. Enough butane to fill, here's a good one, 160 million Bic lighters. Randy, what is going, this is amazing. This pipeline is producing that much fuel and energy for a big chunk of America here. I mean, I'm hoping that this message, and I guess this is part of your rapid response. I mean, all these figures have to make a difference to the people, especially those in the, you know, involved in the legal battle right now, don't you think?
Yeah, look, it absolutely does. And I would say even more than that, you know, when we look at the true numbers, the Toledo Refining Company alone puts $5.4 billion of economic throughput in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan. And for every one of the that at Toledo Refining Company, there are roughly 16 other jobs in the community that depend on those jobs. So, mm-hmm. you know, we can talk about facts and figures, but these are people's lives and livelihoods.
Right.
You know, it's education for their kids. It's honestly money into the community. Because we all know, you know, that oil companies really are a tax driver for these communities. And so, you know, when we think about refineries, when we think about the things that refineries do, it goes so far past just putting the gas in your car at the gas station.
Well, Randy, let's drive people to the website, futureontheline.org, futureontheline.org. And that is the rapid response drive on behalf of the Steelworkers Union, USW.org. And hopefully this can be resolved and keep those jobs and keep those families together. Futureontheline.org. Randy, thank you so much for joining us and keep up the fight, okay?
Yeah, thank you. You have a great day.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, IBEW Local 520 and the Transportation Trades Department of the AFL-CIO. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.